In this episode of Cube FM, I talk with Andrew Jeffrey from Safety Culture about their journey migrating hundreds of microservices to GitOps with Argo CD and without downtime. Andrew walks us through how his team replaced a fragile Helm-based setup with a domain-specific language built in Q, giving developers a cleaner interface and stronger validation. We get into the practical challenges of moving more than 250 applications across clusters, the tricks they use to ensure zero disruption, and how automation like approval bots reshape their operations. It's a deep dive into scaling Kubernetes safely, cutting out YAML pain, and building a developer experience that actually works at scale. Special thanks to TestCube for sponsoring today's episode. Are flaky tests slowing your Kubernetes deployments? TestCube powers continuous cloud-native testing directly inside your Kubernetes clusters. Seamlessly integrate your existing testing tools, scale effortlessly, and release software faster and safer than ever. Stop chasing bugs in production. Start preventing them with TestCube. Check it out at testcube.io. Now, let's get into the episode. All right, Andrew, what are three emerging Kubernetes tools that you're keeping an eye on?
Yeah, that's a really tough one, I think, especially how fast the sort of space is emerging and changing. I think if I had to sort of pick, the first one off the list is probably Argo City Agent. That's sort of a multi-cluster sort of Argo without sort of the detriments of having to sort of do a single sort of management cluster that has all the generation and manifests. I think that's looking really promising, but it's still very early sort of days for that. I'm really excited for the in-place scaling upgrades in Kubernetes 133. Being able to dynamically sort of adjust resources of a pod what's running is going to be really beneficial for some use cases. And I think the other thing I'm sort of, it's not so much an emerging technology, but is the ambient mesh in Istio. It's not fully featured yet, but it's getting closer and closer by the day. And I'm really excited to be able to move to that eventually.
And for folks who don't know you, can you just give us a quick intro about who you are and what you do, where you work?
Sure. So I'm Andrew Jeffrey. I'm a staff cloud infrastructure engineer at a company called Safety Culture based in Sydney. And I work in a team that manages the whole cloud infrastructure platform, Kubernetes deployment, CI, CD, anything like that.
And how did you get into cloud native?
I used to be a Linux systems administrator for a consulting company here in Sydney, and we started selling more cloud solutions, and I started doing more cloud native work realistically, and it just sort of stuck.
Very good. Previously you mentioned around, about the tools, about how the ecosystem moves very quickly. In your experience, what's the best way to stay up to date? Do you read blogs? Do you watch videos? What works best for you?
I tend to read a lot of blogs. I'm also in a lot of community Slacks. Some Discords, various places like that where I see a lot of stuff. Hacker News has always got something, usually of some sort of interest. It's usually just sort of a pick a thing. And I think obviously, we also got a passionate team here internally who are always sort of sharing various articles they've come across in their free time. So there's sort of constant sort of discussion going forth around all sorts of cool new things.
And if you could go back in time and share, a career tip with your younger self, what would it be?
Write more code. I started out as a sort of systems administrator, like I said. These days I'm pretty good at writing code, but there are times where I've sort of looked at things, I think historically looking back and I've gone, that's a code problem, that's not my problem, or I don't want to go into that. That's someone else's problem. If I look back, I could have progressed, I could have done some things differently, I could have solved some problems earlier.
As part of our monthly content discovery, we came across an article that you wrote titled, Our Journey to GitOps, Migrating to Argo CD with Zero Downtime. So we want to look at this a little bit more in detail now. Safety Culture mentioned running hundreds of microservices across multiple Kubernetes clusters. Can you describe your deployment infrastructure before considering any changes?
Yeah, sure. So we operate in three regions. So we have three production clusters. We've got one in Europe, one in America, and one here in Australia. And essentially, we were using Helm. We had a mono repo for all our Helm configurations for our services with sort of a hierarchical sort of config sort of thing. You had a default, you had a global config, and then you still had your sort of environmental level regional sort of configs per service. And it was all sort of YAML stuff. It sort of worked, and there was sort of a pipeline per cluster. And each service pipeline would then trigger these child pipelines saying, I want to deploy this version of the software, and we had templated versions. So we had a microservice Helm chart to just kind of control our template structure to bring in those sort of default standards across all our stuff, and we had the same for cron jobs. And that's what worked And then there was a bunch of other various pipelines that are joining things together to allow people to manually scale things after hours without having to do changes in Git and get approvals. And same for various other factors and that sort of thing. And it was just starting to fall apart a little bit.
It sounds like this Helm-based approach worked initially, but you mentioned it became increasingly painful as you scaled. What specific incidents or pain points made you realize that you needed a different solution?
Yeah, I think it was a bunch of different pain points. Part of it, I think, is YAML's not the nicest language or sort of definition. I don't think I've found anyone who really sort of says, I love it. It's not particularly user-friendly. I guess, you know, if you work in the Kubernetes space, you know that the indentation, you sort of read the specs, you go, oh no, that's, you know, if I'm doing, you know, an image version, that's going to be under image. That's the standard way we write YAML these days for any sort of Kubernetes definition. But, you know, the average software developer doesn't know that. They shouldn't need to know that. And it's just not clear. So there was that, you know, sort of, we're getting those issues, and the inheritance stuff was also causing problems. People would change one thing and then not realize they had to change the other files and stuff like that. That was just causing that pain. And then we also had a lot of incidents in some cases where, you know, the average thing, an engineer gets woken up at 3 a.m. in the morning by an alarm, you know, and they go, oh, you know, we've got more traffic than we expect. The auto scaling hasn't worked for whatever reason. You know, let's investigate that in the morning, because the focus is, you know, remediate, not sort of diagnose the full problem and sort of fix it in exact mitigation. You know, let's remediate, let's just scale it up. And they'd go trigger that in a pipeline. So to avoid that sort of need for review in the Git repo, like we sort of mentioned before, they'd scale that up, you know, and that would just manually do it. It would run the Helm commands, it would grab the things, it would do the version, and it would just do --/ replicas equals blah, you know. And then the next morning, you know, their teammate would come in, you know, bright and early, not having been the one woken up, and they'd go, cool, I'm going to deploy my change from yesterday to production. And they'd click merge, you know, think, oh yeah, sure, there's an incident. That was something unrelated. That'll be fine, you know, for all they know. And they'd unblock it. It would go to production. And we'd be back in that sort of scenario if there was actual underlying root cause of where we needed more replicas, because it would have scaled back down, or any other sort of emergency configuration changes that might have been done if they'd, say, escalated to my team and we did some sort of horrible sort of manual patch in the cluster, just as a sort of a, let's get this working for tonight, no one touches it, you know, and then things happen. So yeah, we had a bunch of cases like that realistically, and it was just becoming more of a problem as we were sort of adding more services, servicing more customers, and getting more business. It was just sort of getting bad for everyone involved.
Given these pain points with Helm, you decided to migrate to GitOps with Argo CD. So some basic questions before we get into it further. Why GitOps? And we might want to add, why Argo, you know, and not Flux? And what were you hoping to achieve with this migration?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess first off, I'm just going to call it was a team effort. You know, I was one of many people on it. You know, I sort of came in halfway through the project when we sort of started the actual migration. So the reason we sort of went with GitOps is we wanted that source of truth. We already kind of were doing something pseudo GitOps with that sort of mono repo with all the Helm configurations. So we were sort of halfway there, I guess, in some aspects. So we really looked at it and went, we want a source of truth. We don't want these places where things drift. You know, we don't want to try and figure out how to parse things and update the right files and everything like that. You know, we want something that's streamlined. We want to move more towards, you know, as we scale, as we sort of add more Kubernetes clusters and stuff, we don't want to have to go, oh, that's another pipeline step we have to add. That's another build, you know, pipeline we have to do, and we have to update all our scripts and everything else. Like, we wanted to sort of move away from that sort of pattern. So it was really just about having that sort of source of truth that was going to automatically reconcile as well, because we had a lot of pain points from developers who would sort of merge their change and they'd see the pipeline go green, but that was just the vetting pipeline and the validation pipeline going, yeah, your config's good. It wasn't a, I've rolled your config change out sort of pipeline. So there's lots of confusion. So we wanted sort of the best of all those worlds to have that, you know, automatic reconciliation, you know, the source of truth, you know, the historical change records. We can more easily track who changed what when and everything else sort of in between. And, you know, as for why Argo, we looked at Flux. I think in the end, we just went with Argo because it had a better plugin architecture, but I'm not fully certain on the specifics there because that was predating my time.
Okay. And instead of simply moving your Helm deployments to Argo CD, you chose to implement a domain-specific language using QLang. Now,
for folks that are out there, that may not have experience. It sounds like a pretty significant investment. What drove that decision?
Yeah, I mean, it was a complex decision. We devalued a bunch of things. You know, we looked at keeping the Helm charts. We looked at, you know, using KCL. We looked at using a bunch of other languages. We looked at running some stuff in Go to just output stuff ourselves. In the end, we really wanted to think more from the developer experience perspective of wanting to have a platform internally and having a clear interface that we've defined, especially as we sort of grow and offer more capabilities as a platform group. You know, so if we add, you know, Cater for scaling, for example, we want that to be more magic instead of it being, you know, set Cater and then set all these various arguments below it sort of thing and figure all this stuff out. We want it just to be, say, I want metric-based scaling and I want it to be for my Kafka and we figure the rest out behind the scenes and just to have that better interface. So yeah, in the end, we decided to go down that DSL path and you know, we adopted Qlang very early. We adopted it version 0.3 or 0.4 and it's still relatively early. It's now on 0.13 as of a week or two ago and they've got 0.14 in release calendar. But yeah, it was a good decision, I think, in hindsight, but there were a lot of challenges with it at times as well.
You mentioned that Qlang can import and validate against existing Go types and OpenAPI schemas from Kubernetes and CRDs. How has this schema validation capability prevented issues in production?
Yeah, so I think part of it is, you know, we've obviously got CI checks in the pipelines. You know, with that, we can run Q commands to validate our Q configurations. And part of that is, since it's imported the schemas, it imports any validations on those schemas around requirements. You know, required fields, regex checks, min, all that sort of stuff, and you're required everything else in between. And that means that when you go to render out a manifest using Q, it actually says, well, hold on, you're missing a required field, or what you've given me doesn't actually match what the required values of that are. So it means we can capture a lot earlier, versus with Helm, you can write it, and everyone can sort of look at it and go, yeah, that looks good. You just look at YAML, right? Or usually some templating on top of YAML, which makes it even more complex at times. You're just going, everyone's sort of eyeballing it, going, yeah, that looks good. And then you have to sort of maybe manually deploy into a cluster and find out whether it's all there and sort of check and make sure it's all good, you know? And you probably have to have all this sort of extra checking around your limits and what's to make sure you're over-defining a limit that's actually in the CRD that you're not controlling. Versus, you know, we have that native checking there. So it means we can catch things way earlier, like the PR, when someone raises the PR changing something, you know, it runs all these checks, the PR just will not pass the CR checks, so the subscripts cannot be merged. And, you know, we can surface those areas to people much earlier instead of it being back in the Helm world with the YAML, you know, I put the field in the YAML, it was the wrong indentation or the wrong spot, it passed because it's technically valid YAML, you know, and Helm would ignore fields it doesn't care about. As such, you know, that's good. That's good for me to merge. And then they go to deployment and go, my change didn't apply. Why are my replicas still set to 10 or whatever? And it's, oh, because you have to set it this way or this, you know. So, yeah.
With 250 to 300, you know, applicants across 20 teams, this migration sounds massive. Walk us through your strategy and why you chose a team-by-team approach.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a lot of services. Thankfully, we do have a lot of standards around the way we build services. We're at that sort of point where we've got naming standards. We write majority of our stuff in Golang. We use sort of internal modules to sort of standardize a lot of stuff that's made things a little bit easier. But fundamentally, it's your, with any sort of large scale project, you've got to start somewhere and you've got to have a plan of how you're going to get there. You can't just sort of go into this and piecemeal do bits and pieces. You have to have sort of achievable goals, especially to report up to your leadership. You know, to sort of say, hey, I'm doing my job and this is sort of our achievable sort of metrics. And also to deliver, you know, show value internally to engineering that we're making progress on that project we've talked about. So in terms of teams, you know, most of our teams are for the most part working just on their services. So that makes it a really easy sort of boundary to easily move things and determine when to move something versus sort of trying to go, oh, we'll move this one here, then this one here and all that sort of stuff. It also meant there was a clear developer experience sort of benefit instead of having that sort of cognitive difficulty with, you know, oh, this service that I own is on this system in Argo, but this system's actually over here on Helm, you know, which one's which? Which one do I use in the middle of the night when I get woken up for my service? You know, how do I do anything with this? You know, if it's constantly moving underfoot while we're sort of going apart, going along, it's no good. So it was really about just doing team by team, and also meant we could focused on supporting them as well. You know, we could sit, we would meet the team beforehand, you know, we'd sit down, we'd have an actual meeting, we'd go through some slides talking about what the actual benefits were, not just why we were changing for the sake of change, because that was a lot of the perception initially, was that the platform team's putting in some technology for the sake of putting in some technology. And we're like, no, this brings benefits to you. These are the benefits. We talked about that sort of scaling issues that a lot of teams have, you know, in the middle of the night. We're like, look, who here has been woken up in that situation? Who's here then had the next morning when they broke the something, you know? And who here doesn't want to have that happen again? This is how we're doing it, you know? So it's very much about showing them how we're solving the pain that they're experiencing and what benefits it brings, instead of it just being, here's the new thing we're doing, align sort of thing.
Like that. Your zero downtime migration process involved creating temporary deployments with a temp suffix. Can you explain this technique and how it ensured no customer disruption?
Sure. So that was actually a really clever thing by someone here. So essentially we were looking at how do we do this to make sure there's, you know, since we're moving configurations across and everything else, there'll be some level of drift and people are human, mistakes happen. So how do we mitigate it? So we looked at it and we ended up doing, let's do a temporary deployment. You know, it was a separate name. We kept the old deployment that was still there from Helm. And essentially what we did is we made sure they had the same labels, which meant the selectors on the virtual services and everything else meant traffic would go to the new temporary ones and we could make sure that things were healthy. We then leveraged Argo City's prune last sync options, essentially, on the legacy deployment, which is the one without the temporary suffix in this particular structure. And that meant that Argo would not prune that, e.g. remove the resource, which it wanted to do because it was told not to have it there, until the temporary one was healthy. And Argo actually checks the health checks on pods, and we were also checking metrics and obviously checking our dashboards for every service as we went through that sort of process. And that meant that we could be confident that the working pods in situation were not going to be removed if the new pods were not healthy. And that did save us quite a few times where we'd find that, oh, this service has some extra configuration, or this service for some reason is unhappy. You know, there was a lot of situations where that saved us quite a bit. I think the biggest sort of example of that would be we had maybe a dozen services that are singletons, which means we only run one copy of them because of their sort of nature, and we can't run multiple copies of them without having sort of potential issues. And so we were looking at how to migrate those without sort of downtime. And obviously, you know, you can't have multiple copies of that. That's a problem. So one of the other engineers was sort of talking about this, and he said, oh, let's just implement leader election into those services. This way we can run multiple copies. And, you know, even if the other two copies or whatever we decide as our base replica count are sort of sitting there empty, sitting there doing nothing, it means we're more resilient, because it means if, you know, the original pod that was the leader goes away, the other two, one of the other two can be elected leader much quicker than it would take to launch a new node, download the image, launch the pod on it, get it healthy, and then elect, which means better. So yeah, we made sure to go ahead of time with that learning and just get that change into all services that were singletons before we got those services in the future for the migration.
You encountered some technical challenges during the migration, particularly with your DSL coverage and Argo CV performance. How did you handle these issues while maintaining the migration momentum?
It was hard. A lot of it was very long days and a lot of angry, rude words at various programming software. You know, we have services, like I said earlier, a lot of our services comply with our standards. You know, as with every rule, there's exceptions to it. And those exceptions are usually either your older services that have been around since before time, but at the same time, the sort of linchpin critical service to the entire platform, or they're services that you've brought across as part of an acquisition. You know, so in our case, it was sort of a mix of that. We were sort of actively bringing in some services we'd come across as part of an acquisition, bringing them into the actual system. And that meant that they needed to have extra configuration to work in the way we needed them to while we were still untangling things. Then we had some legacy ones that were just missing certain functionality, or there was hard-coded logic in our Helm charts going, you know, if service name is this, do this configuration, which you don't find very easily. But thankfully, with the way we'd set things up in Argo, we'd set the application up in what we call diffing mode, essentially, which is essentially with sync turned off. You know, it wouldn't automatically sync. And that allowed us to then look at Argo and see what the differences were, or all the resources, to then ensure that we had all the configuration aligned. And if it wasn't, we could then go track down what was missing and then go at it, essentially. Thankfully, it was only a small subset of things we were generally missing, so it wasn't too much effort to usually keep on top of it. And if it was, we usually went, okay, let's, what we're going to do is we're going to move this team back a little bit further in the list of teams we're going to migrate. We'll work on doing these fixes in between to the DSL to make sure we've got all the coverage we need. We'll update our test services to sort of cover these new features, and we'll work on other teams that are sort of more standardized in the meantime while we work on that.
So the migration delivered several measurable improvements, from automated reconciliation to environment-wide deployments. Which improvements have had the biggest impact on your team's daily operations?
Yeah, I think the GitOps approach fully adopting that GitOps approach realistically is what's been the biggest benefit to the teams. Like I said before, we kind of had pseudo sort of GitOps, but it wasn't tracking like versions, for example. So we didn't have that disaster recovery aspect. So it meant if we spun up a new cluster or needed to recover a cluster, we'd have to go re-trigger every service pipeline to get those deployments out and those right versions everywhere, which is a huge amount of work. Moving to this new model with GitOps with the DSL, we can also roll out platform-wide changes, either at the environmental level or even across the whole platform if they're very safe, in a more structured manner, and make sure they get applied when we want them to be applied, instead of relying on either waiting for teams to eventually having to redeploy every single service progressively over however long they take to sort of deploy the services, or us having gone and redeployed every service to get those new changes in. So that's been a real big sort of time saver, and I think having that sort of history as well of change.
The article mentions you developed automated approval workflows, including bots that review scaling adjustments. Can you explain how this automation has changed your operational model?
Yeah, so obviously in that case I mentioned before, the middle of the night wake up, we initially didn't have that when we initially moved to the DSL, and the first sort of team, I think, was the one that caught it. They woke up about 2 days later in the middle of the night, and they went, oh, the scaling change that we need to make via here, that needs approval. And they woke up their secondary who approved their PR for scaling, but they're like, we shouldn't have to wake up two people to scale a service in the middle of the night. It's not efficient. It's not great. Neither of us were happy about it. Please fix this. And so we looked at it a bit, and essentially it's like, we don't want no ownership on the files because then anyone can merge them. But we essentially went, let's have a GitHub bot where essentially it can vet the change. Since it's queue, once again, we can validate changes. You have a schema we can validate against to make sure they're not going above our sort of required minimums and maxims and stuff like that. And we can essentially also have a specific file format. So we then structure it so that we have a GitHub bot that goes, if it's from an approved author, if it's a change to this specific file, they're only changing one service, they're only changing it for one environment or one region or whatever we sort of define the rule as, it can then sort of run a bunch of checks, make sure it's all good, and then approve the PR. And then the developer can then merge it themselves in the middle of the night without needing to wake anyone up. And that does still get recorded in sort of a log so we can then go look if we need to.
You've shared several valuable lessons that you learned, including respect muscle memory and plan for scale from the beginning. What advice would you give to teams considering a similar migration?
Yeah, I think in regards to muscle memory, I think it's really about the interface that you provide to developers. Look, we did shift the interface a fair bit on them in terms of moving to queue from your YAML definitions. I'd talk more about the tooling in this case. So we have these pipelines for scaling changes, for example, and all the runbooks people had were, go to this pipeline, do this. Well, it was muscle memory for them after years I go here into our IDP and I click this button and I fill in the form and it does the scaling change for me and all the work, And a lot of cases, what we had to do was update those tools to go be smarter, realistic, and go, is this tool migrated? If so, return something clear to them saying, no, that's not the way to do it. Go here. Or better yet, do it for them the new way and then tell them, hey, FYI, this is the new way. We've done it for you this time. We don't promise this will continue to work. But it's really about making sure that there was a lot of pain in doing that at times because it's a lot of bash scripts fundamentally. And bash is, a little painful and it's, a little hard at times to write some complex scripts, especially as you add more logic into it, it becomes sort of its own application almost. And it got to the point that we have these really complex bash scripts and it's like, do we continue to invest effort in these scripts or do we push people towards, using the new patterns? And it was sort of a balance of trying to find that middle ground of it's easier in some cases to go, let's eat the cost and the pain of maintaining these scripts and tools. And we slowly rewrite more of them into proper languages as proper tools so that teams can continue to have a central place to do things in the same interface, or at least a very similar interface, instead of it being a complete shift of mindset. And over time, we're slowly getting rid of some of those older interfaces to sort of reduce technical debt on ourselves to sort of do that. So yeah, that's how we dealt with the sort of the muscle memory stuff and why it's crucially important. It's really a developer experience sort of problem. You just need to make sure that they're your customer, and you need to make sure that you keep your customer happy.
Looking forward, you mentioned implementing Argo rollouts and evolving toward a more pure GitOps approach. The article also briefly mentions using pre-sync hooks for database migrations. How do these fit into your future GitOps workflow?
Yeah, I think they all fit in at various points. So part of it's part of the, separation of CI and CD is really where the sort of whole project starts. The sort of holy grail of DevOpsy sort of platform engineering is that separation of state. Longer term, obviously, the long-term vision that we have is to our build pipelines should build the image, run tests, any sort of CI level testing, unit testing, that sort of stuff, build it, check it. After it's built, the pipeline's green, deployment is no longer the developer's problem. That's the long-term vision. To do that, though, there is some need for sort of safety and surety. We had teams previously that were using one of our clusters just by nature of the way the pipelines were set up as sort of a canary cluster, because we're used to allow promotion between regions in our production environment. So they could deploy to our European region, then our US region, then our Australian region, sort of thing, with individual sort of blocks. When we moved to Argo, we actually removed that and we went, you are doing an environmental deployment. You do not get to choose which region or which cluster you go to and which order. That is no longer an option. Use feature flagging, use proper ways of managing your risk. Test things earlier, validate things earlier, which we're already doing a lot of, but we're just reinforcing that sort of messaging and that sort of practices. And we went through with that and we went, this is how we're going to do it. So a lot of it came down to how do we leverage this and how do we enable some of these patterns? Because a lot of the time teams were using these things going, we still need that surety to make sure that when we deploy, it's safe, because some of our services are very big and very complex and, your identity services, for example, everyone depends on your identity services, usually. Every other service generally needs to talk to your identity services in some manner for something. So it's how do we deal with that? How do we give them the surety that their software can do that? And so really we looked at rollouts and we're like, how do we give, this way we can give you proper canary deployments instead of it being environmental canaries. It's canaries in the clusters. We can use metric promotion to actually evaluate whether something's healthy or not. We can look at your metrics that you can define on your application to determine my HTTP metrics are good, my custom metrics for this endpoint and this endpoint and all the things I care about, they're good. This is good to promote. I can promote it to 50% and I can run the same checks or I can run tests or whatever else sort of, you want. Argo rollouts keeps extending more features, which is just really great. In regards to the pre-sync stuff, once again, it came to run DB migrations, you need access to your databases. And why have that run in CI? Then your CI systems need access to your production environment. It's a security 101. Don't do that. So we're looking at just going, how do we move this out? How do we get this to happen? But we still have the need of, if the database migrations fail, we need not to deploy the service because the service probably depends on those database migrations having run. So how do we make sure that happens? So we looked and went, okay, let's move it to pre-sync hooks. Let's use pre-sync jobs. And that's worked out really well. There's been some initial teething issues with that, but most of it's been just, tooling around observability and making sure we surface the information in the right way back to the developer saying, your application failed to sync. It failed to sync because your DB migrations failed, not due to one of the myriad of other reasons they could go down the rabbit hole looking for.
And Andrew, for teams out there that are currently struggling with similar Helm-based deployment challenges at scale, what would be your key takeaway from this entire migration experience?
It's tough. I think it really depends on where you are as a maturity cycle of your sort of deployments. I think Helm has its place. I don't know if it's something I would do again. I don't think I'd adopt Helm personally if I went to a new organization. I know they're talking about a major rework as to Helm v4. I've not looked into any depth as to see what improvements that may bring to maybe change my mind. I would err on the side of, if you're going to build a platform, which I think most people are looking to do, if there's something out of the box that can do that for you, or there's more templated stuff, Timoni comes to mind. I think that's how you pronounce it. It's another thing written in Q, actually, that's sort of you doing something very similar to what we've done internally. You know, use some sort of DSL and build your platform out with that. And that allows you to sort of do that migration. And then have a clear plan, have a clear testing strategy, test things properly, have that scale and validate everything and have those clear documentation in advance for your users.
One of the things for me in this conversation is, you know, repeatedly mentioning, if this problem happens, how many people have to wake up? And you know that really building the human-based, you know, empathy that at the end of the day, we choose this solution, but what's that going to involve in terms of the, you know, human effort that's going to be necessary to move things forward? What do you think is causing some organizations to not see that? And what can be done to have a more, you know, human-centric approach of really understanding that as much as we're talking about very technical things, at the end of the day, we're talking about quality of life for people. I've been, you know, working in companies where DevOps teams, you know, taking an extra phone with them to have Ops Genie available, you know, 24/7, 365. Some people have children, they're waking up in the middle of the night and having to address incidents. I've seen coworkers have to take out a laptop in a gym or at a company, you know, dinner, things like that. What piece of advice would you have for you know, teams that are out there that want to build this more into their strategy? What are the things that they should consider?
I think a core building block is empathy, realistically. You know, you should be on call. You should be available as an escalation point, you know, as much as I don't like getting woken up either. You know, no one wants to get woken up, right? And I think it's thinking of, you know, they're doing their best not to get woken up by their own, by problems they have the power to fix. You know, you should be doing the best as the person who provides a service to them to make sure the service you're providing is either as, obviously, is as stable as you can make it, you know, and that if it does need something that they need intervention for, they can self-service that fix. You know, you need to learn from their incidents. You need to attend their postmortems. You need to work with them. It's a partnership. It's not a, you know, dictatorship, realistically. You can't just go out there and say, this is how it's going to be. You know, that's not, it's not about making enemies. It's about making friends. You know, you need to work with them, your coworkers. You know, you need to, I guess, kind of act like a product team. You know, product designers, you know, they go out and speak to their customers. They do user research. They show them things. They say, hey, here's what we're thinking. Here's what we think this might work. Here's how we think this will work. You know, what do you see wrong with this? Because you're only looking from your lens. And you can put yourself in their shoes to an extent, but if you're not living in their shoes, you're going to miss things. So you need to speak to them. You need to involve them frequently. And don't be afraid to ship something early. Like, ship it iteratively, like do small bits, like go, okay, look, and share the roadmap. Go, look, longer term, we're going to have this automatic rollout promotion. But first, we're just going to have rollouts where you can manually promote things just to get confidence and understanding what the underlying technology is doing for you. And then it'll be like, then we can sit down and you go, okay, if we were to remove those manual steps, what are you doing in those manual steps? What are you looking at? How are you validating that? What's your concerns? What things would you like to do that you don't do because it's painful? How can we automate that? How can we improve that?
Andrew, what's next for you?
I'm working on a bunch of projects as per usual. Being a staff engineer, I don't usually get to just do one thing. I'm currently rebuilding our development environment. We've got 60 plus namespaces in our development environment, and each of them has a copy of every service. And it means it's actually a bigger cluster than any of our production clusters. It costs more money than any of them, and it's not really production-like due to the nature of it. So it ends up being quite clunky and quite painful. So I'm in the process of rebuilding that into a new model where we have a single namespace, and then we have just the dependent services that someone's testing deployed, and we use header-based routing for them.
How can people get in touch with you?
Best method's probably LinkedIn. As much as it's the bane of everyone's existence, it's a good filtering tool. You know, if you send me a message, I'm usually happy to respond or connect with me. If you can't send me a message, you know, I don't bite. Or I'm on various community Slacks as well. If you're on the various CNCF Slacks and various others, you'll probably find me loitering in there as well if you feel free to send me a message.
Fantastic. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and experience with us today, and look forward to talking to you in the future. Take care.
No worries. Thank you for having me.